All right, welcome everyone. I'm sure we'll have a couple more stragglers come in, but want to get started and not waste any time on this because we've got a lot of interesting stuff to talk about today. I'm Scott Dodd. I will be your moderator today. When we get to the Q&A portion of the session, the rules are SEJ members and working journalists ask questions first. I'll know your blue badges. So, and we want everyone to speak clearly. The session is being recorded. We will repeat questions up here on the microphone so that people who are listening in afterward will be able to hear. So anyway, thank you very much for coming. We're here today to talk about a awfully fun topic, doomsday reporting. So, and I just wanted to start off with a sort of quick slideshow to sort of provide some definition for what we mean when we talk about doomsday reporting. So, let's see here. So humans have been telling themselves stories about the end of the world for a very long time now. And not much has changed. People still love speculating about what's going to wipe us out or what's going to bring doomsday. But as environmental journalists, often it really is our job to report on things that could end the world, or at least provide pretty significant catastrophes or things like that. And there's just there are a wide range of threats out there to the world as we know it, quite frankly. So that can take that kind of reporting can take many forms. There were journalists, including some in this room, who predicted what might happen to New Orleans if a storm like Hurricane Katrina hit, and it did. There's one journalist on this panel who predicted Hurricane Harvey and the impact that that Houston would experience if hit by a major hurricane. Elizabeth Culbert's book on how climate change is wiping out species and the impact that could have. Our conference host here in Pittsburgh reported on the threat of coal ash even before storage ponds across the country started to leak and break and cause all kinds of problems. There was this story in The New Yorker a couple years ago, which kept everyone in Grist's hometown of Seattle up nights for weeks after it appeared. This is the one that David did earlier this summer that kind of had everyone talking about it because of the framing that it took and the way he approached a subject that many of us have covered of climate change. So, it led to what I'd say is safe to say a rather unprecedented amount of feedback for you guys, right? So, and it wasn't just from the usual suspects like fossil fuel companies or developers who might have financial reasons to poo-poo a journalist's alarm. Some of the criticism was fact-based, but an awful lot of it came down to framing and how David chose to approach the topic of climate change. So that's kind of an introduction to what we're here to talk about today, which is the choice to do these kinds of stories, whether they work and what that even means, the ethical considerations to take into account when crafting one, and then what kind of advice the people on this panel can give to writers who choose to tackle these kind of stories, to do them both ethically and effectively. So I'm privileged to be joined by kind of an all-star panel here, folks who have done these kind of stories, folks who have studied these kinds of stories. These are their names, affiliations, and most importantly, their Twitter handles, so that you can tweet out the really exciting and insightful things that they have to say. Please use the hashtag SEJ2017. And if you happen to be one of the lucky people who already has 280 characters and you want to add in a second hashtag, you can throw in the SEJ Doom hashtag just to locate it to this panel. So rather than wasting time with introductions, I'm just going to jump right in and start by asking David, why did you want to write a story on climate change's worst case scenarios, and why did you choose to approach it in the way that you did?
Well, the short answer is just it seemed like a great story that hadn't been told in a publication like the one that I worked for, New York Magazine. I was somebody who read a lot about climate and about science, enough to, you know, into journals and into sort of obscure environmental publications, and to see a lot of really alarming news that seemed to me not really being surfaced in places like, say, the New York Times or, you know, the Washington Post, other places. And I felt like there was a great story to tell there. My impulse was on some level narrative first. And I thought that there were basically two big ways that that story had not made its way into the public. The first was that I think people had a pretty good sense that climate change was going to bring us to about 2 to 2.5 degrees of warming. They understood that, which is what most scientists understand is the median outcome, but didn't understand like the whole other side of the bell curve, what could happen if things were worse than the median outcome. And they also understood the effects in terms of sea level rise, which are going to be really bad. But as I saw it, hadn't quite reckoned with all of the other ways that climate change could affect our lives in really crippling ways. And so I wanted to write a story that surveyed that second half of the bell curve and spelled out exactly what it would mean for each of these scenarios. I wrote it, you know, as I say, mostly as a sort of journalist, mostly interested in telling a story that hadn't been told before. But, you know, like anybody who writes about climate, I was also motivated in part by the desire to open people's eyes. And I thought that there was a kind of argument for alarmism there, too, because, you know, I know that there's a lot of worry about kind of burnout among advocates, and people worry about, you know, just too much, knowing too much, being too scared and getting turning into despair. But for me, as someone who sort of came late to climate and climate writing, it seemed sort of obvious to me that the world was too complacent about climate change, not too scared about climate change. And when you look at the polls, you know, it seems basically true that most Americans are worried about climate change. They're concerned about it. It's just a very low-level concern for them. And it seemed to me pretty intuitive that the thing that would make it more of a concern would be if they were more informed about what could go wrong. It didn't seem to me like you could look at those polls and say, well, we're at a tipping point where everybody's just going to give up if climate change is, you know, only somebody's seventh or eighth political priority. I went out and I interviewed a bunch of scientists. I read a bunch of papers and sort of processed them in my own sort of general interest prose, and then showed them to the people whose work I was summarizing to make sure I was like on the right page before publishing, and then let it out into the world and like, you know, really kicked up a storm.
Yeah. So for those who didn't follow the reaction to it as closely as some others might have, can you talk about some of the reaction that you got to the story and what may have surprised you most about some of those reactions?
Well, I mean, the first thing was just the scale of it. It's the most read story that New York Magazine's ever published, which is amazing in that the thing it knocked out of the top seat was a nude photo portfolio of Lindsay Lohan, which, I mean, tells you a little bit about the kind of weird mix of things that New York Magazine publishes. But also, I think it's like a great cause for optimism that, you know, I've been in this business for a while, and typically climate news, environmental writing has been understood as traffic kryptonite. And this was real evidence that, like, if you wrote it in a narrative way, that people would respond. So I think at the moment we're, like, approaching 6 million readers or something.
Wow.
And that's really blown anything like it that we've ever done out of the water. So the scale was really notable. And it wasn't just, you know, the number of people who read it. It was the kind of people who read it and the kind of people who were interested in arguing about it that was really notable. You know, within a few days there was think pieces written in The Atlantic and Slate and a bunch of other places about how appropriate the framing had been, how legitimate the science in the story had been. And that was really gratifying and flattering, honestly, even though some of it was, you know, took issue with the piece. It was amazing to see all these people whose work I admired and in many cases whose work I had built my own story on, engaging with it in such a deep way. That was fantastic. And really glad to have, you know, having come at the story from the perspective that I did, really glad to see a kind of public debate sparked about just how appropriate it is to talk about unlikely but possible horrifying scenarios, how we should process those possibilities when we think about climate policy and climate and our sort of culture of, around climate change. And, you know, I found some of the scientific criticism a little unfair personally, and wish that in a lot of the commentary it had been it would made clear that, like, most of the critique was really of the framing, and that while there were a couple of particular factual points that people took issue with, nobody was really taking an issue with the broad proposition of the piece, that is, if we get to 5 degrees or 8 degrees of warming, that the world will be really devastated in all of these ways. I think, especially after we published this, this is sort of a side note, but especially after we published this annotated version of the piece where we showed all the work and all the sources and all the interviews, the sort of scientific questions were relatively put to bed. But I think the big framing conversation is a really important one, which is one reason I'm really glad to be here with all you guys. And all you guys to be talking about it today.
So one of the criticisms that there was a in the slide that I showed, there was a headline about that scaring people about climate change doesn't work. I think by work the idea is it's not effective in going and getting them to take action if they're scared about it. So Renee, I wanted to ask you, as a psychologist who has studied climate change communication, you know, what do we know about the effectiveness of scaring people as a way of trying to get them to take action? And how does it compare to other forms of messaging, whether it might be hopeful or solutions-based or things like that?
Right. Thank you.
Let's slide that over.
So, hi, everyone. So this question really, I think, gets to the heart of what it means to be an effective environmental journalist, quite frankly, because the work that we're talking about and reporting on is, in fact, incredibly distressing, hard stuff to be confronting. And we do know a lot already within the psychological world, whether it's neuroscience or cognitive or behavioral or psychodynamic. We know a lot right now about how people respond to stress, anxiety, and fear. And, you know, one of the things I'm really interested in is looking at how we can leverage that or tap into that to support how we communicate. So what we do know is that fear, anxiety, distress tends to have a paralyzing, numbing effect that neurologically, you know, y'all may know that when our limbic system is activated, we literally lose our prefrontal cortex, kind of access to that in terms of our capacity to literally learn, to literally take in whatever information you all are trying to communicate. I can't actually really process it or deal with it if I'm experiencing some guilt or shame or conflict or confusion or anxiety. So that's kind of basic, established at this point. Yes, fear can spark short-term bursts of activity. We all know that as well. But whether it's in the public health sector or whatever, I mean, there's so much evidence now about this. So that presents the challenge for us, which is, what do we do with that? And I think one of the most important things to think about is to, one, just blow up this dichotomy or this tendency to frame things within our own community between doom and fear and hope and positivity, that in itself reproduces another psychologically kind of inauthentic, out-of-touch mode. If you think about in our own lives, we don't really ping-pong necessarily between, oh, I'm going to be happy, and positive solutions, or everything's dire. It's actually more nuanced. It's more complicated. It's more kind of woven together. And so I was one of the folks that wrote a piece in response for Sierra Magazine where I proposed that we kind of blow up this hope, despair conversation, frankly, and think more about, in light of what we know psychologically, what's most coherent. And in my experience, one of the things that's really powerful and coherent is the ability to weave together multiple strands of narrative that avoid that yes, we need to raise awareness and say what's going on, and we need to include what Steve Curwood was talking about, the salve for the wounds, whether that's what is actually happening or sparks of possibility and so forth. And we need to also find ways to affirm and recognize to our audiences that this is overwhelming. It can be overwhelming and distressing. And what happens when you even acknowledge that is it actually helps people hear and take in what you have to say more. So you're talking about a disaster that could be coming. The tendency is to shut down, and actually the polls show that people aren't concerned. That's a defense mechanism against feeling overwhelmed. So I don't think we can read too much into a lack of concern. It's how we protect ourselves. So if we want to be connecting with people, you know, ways of meeting all of that as effectively as possible is something I'm really interested in. And I don't, you know, it's kind of a place of innovating and experimenting with how we can do that.
Jennifer, you've done some research about gloom and doom in ocean science reporting specifically. And I think as environmental journalists, we all kind of struggle with that idea of, like, you know, gloom and doom in our work. And so I wanted to ask what you found and what your recommendations are based on that.
Yeah, so one of the, I guess, ways I'm interested in doom and gloom is kind of in the same way I'm interested in scientific uncertainty or in, I also study negotiations in Antarctica, and they use this term rational use. And all three of these terms, it seems to me, are being they're value-laden terms. They're used to express values rather than describe something specifically problematic. And I'll like a little bit of what that means is that, you know, when society is pushing back against climate scientists, then they emphasize scientific uncertainty in a way that they don't do with regards to health and human safety, for instance. And it seems to me that what we're finding is that doom and gloom is used in a way to attack journalists or an outlet and also sometimes by scientists themselves in a strategic way to sort of say that this piece is acting against a sort of set of social values rather than is classically doom and gloom. Now, we just analyzed 169 ocean-related articles because in the oceans, you might remember a story actually about all fish stocks going extinct by 2048. I studied that piece and then the media that came about as a result of that piece pretty extensively. When looking at the actual journalism that's gone on since 2001 to the present, we're finding, and this is with a student at the University of Miami, Lisa Johns, that only about 10% of articles actually contain doom and gloom language, despite people saying there's all this doom and gloom around the ocean. Actually, most articles are really actually optimistic. There's optimistic language in about 27% of articles. Half of almost all articles suggest solutions. But I think you'd still say, yeah, but I do kind of sense what they mean about this doom and gloom issue. And I think that's a little bit also why we're here, that these doom and gloom pieces tend to get a lot of attention. So while they don't represent necessarily the bulk of reporting by any means, there are, like the 2048 story I mentioned, like the Cascade earthquake, like David's piece. And I think we need to question, like, oh, if these pieces aren't effective, why do they get so much traction? Why do they get so much attention? If fear is not effective, why do we have the president we have? I just think I think there are really deep questions, I guess, to be asked about when this framing is appropriate. And then also, as I mentioned, this sort of meta question on the use of doom and gloom as a framing, actually as a political tool to say, we actually just don't like this outlet, or we don't like this journalist, or we don't like this conclusion, i.e. that we may have to compromise a lot about our everyday lives. And so we're going to call that doom and gloom.
So I think we'll probably come back to some of this when we get to the Q&A. But Nina, I wanted to turn to your coverage of Houston and talk about that a little bit, because so much of it came true over the summer with Hurricane Harvey. You know, you approached your stories in a different way than David did. I think, you know, a little more what we would consider maybe traditionally journalistic, traditionally investigative. But I wonder how much you thought about this question of sort of the doomsday narrative when writing your stories, and if that entered into the way that you approached it.
Sure. I mean, I guess I'm going to be the pesky panelist that disagrees with the term doomsday reporting. That's fine. I mean, in the title of the panel. I really think that in the case of our reporting and in the case of some of the other reporting you cited, notably Mark's reporting pre-Katrina, I mean, I just don't consider these to be doomsday scenarios, even before they happen. And this is why, I mean, a huge reason that we did Hell and High Water, which, by the way, is not the scenario that obviously occurred in Houston. That was more kind of on a boomtown, floodtown of a follow-up investigation we did about rainfall-based flooding in Houston. But in any case, you know, in 2008, Hurricane Ike hit Texas, hit the Gulf Coast. It was the third costliest, well, forgetting Harvey, it was the third costliest hurricane that had hit the United States in modern history until then. It didn't get as much attention as a lot of the others. It was kind of hitting around the same time as the financial crisis. And they really thought Hurricane Ike was going to be the big one. And, you know, my boss, Evan Smith, CEO of the Texas Tribune, actually interviewed Governor Rick Perry when he was governor a few years ago and asked him, what is the moment that defined you as governor? And he mentioned Hurricane Ike, and this was when they thought the hurricane was going to hit the Houston Ship Channel head on and that thousands of people were going to die. They thought this was going to happen about 6 hours before the hurricane turned. So this is not doomsday reporting, in my opinion. I mean, this almost happened. Politicians knew that it could happen. They were terrified. And they know that it will happen. So what we wanted to do was talk about Ike, talk about what that scenario was, look at the scientific work that's been done since then to show what would have happened had Ike taken its original course. Scientists were very generous with us in giving us their data. We wanted to present that data to the public because we felt like that was an important thing for us to do, that the public needed to see this work. They needed to understand the consequences. So I would say that's really where we were going with it. And so we weren't, you know, our goal was not to scare people. Our goal was to present this information and also to point out that people know this is going to happen. Politicians know this is going to happen. And they know what the solutions are, and they're sitting back. So I think that's just a huge point to make as well, is that this is not us just coming up with something out of thin air or even just presenting scientific research. These scientists have been trying to talk to these officials, local, federal, state, politicians, policymakers, bureaucrats, and say, you know this is going to happen. What are we going to do about it? And we wanted to get that conversation going more. So that's just one, you know, that's one thing that really informed how we did our reporting. So, you know, we wanted to talk about this almost happened. Politicians know it could happen. And then we wanted to talk about solutions. And I think that's what one thing that is, you know, I think it's a really good point that when you just talk about the doomsday, it paralyzes people. And we, you know, we got some of that criticism with Hell and High Water as well. But I think we tried really hard to show possible solutions in our series. Not just long-term solutions like the so-called Ike Dike or Coastal Spine, which is actually a storm surge barrier, you know, that would be built in Galveston Bay that would protect from a devastating storm surge. You know, that's going to take years to build. It's going to cost like $20 billion, maybe more. You know, hard to know whether that's going to be built before the big storm. But also other things like public awareness about this. I mean, we know that during Ike, for instance, they were expecting a 20-foot storm surge in the Clear Lake area. You know, and there are a lot of homes that are elevated, but, you know, you would have seen several feet of water in people's homes. And the projection is that thousands of people might have been killed. Luckily, Clear Lake did not get that storm surge, but people didn't evacuate. People didn't evacuate. And so a lot of people, you know, I did a lot of interviews after the series came out. And one of the things I really felt like could come across is if people in Houston read this series, hopefully they will take this seriously the next time there is a warning like this. So that's a short-term solution. And the long-term solutions we also visualized in our series. And it was a complicated thing to do. I give credit to Al Shaw and Jeff Larson of ProPublica for doing these incredible visualizations for our series. But we tried to show the solution so that it wasn't just the sort of, this terrible thing is going to happen and, you know, we should, you know, all just sit back and freak out. There are solutions. They've been talked about for years. And we wanted to get them in front of people a little bit more. So I hope that kind of answers the question.
Yeah, and so what has the impact of those stories been? I mean, do you feel that have those solutions been implemented? Are people more aware? You know, when Harvey did come through, were there things that were different as a result of the reporting that you had done over the past year?
I do think that when Harvey happened, our reporting got tremendous attention. And it's interesting. I'll just give one anecdote. So when we were working on Hell and High Water, we were trying to engage with the mayor of Houston, Sylvester Turner, and he was kind of new at the time. And we were asking him, you know, would you support a storm surge barrier? And the answer we got from his office, and it's in our story, is basically Houston is not all that at risk from storm surge. We're more concerned about wind damage. And he actually told, well, his office told us to go, they were like, we want the public to go to a website called, I'm not kidding, HoustonHideFromTheWind.org. Like, it, and we actually went back and forth with his office, and we said, are you sure that this is what you want to say? You know, here's what the scientists have told us. It's true that within the city of Houston boundaries, you know, Houstonians have tried to say Houston isn't a coastal city because it's, you know, inland and there's this ship channel. But at the end of the day, you know, if all the municipalities around Houston are underwater, the city of Houston is going to be affected. It was kind of a crazy argument. And a few days after Harvey, I was back in Houston, and I'm interviewing their flood czar, and they've appointed this guy a year before because of all this rain-based flooding they've been getting. And he's like, oh, I have to go downstairs for this press conference about the Ike Dike. And I was like, why are they having a press conference about the Ike Dike? And it's Mayor Turner and all of the people we interviewed for our series, Hell and High Water, scientists, business officials who've been advocating for this coastal spine, saying we need to get this coastal spine built. So I think that it may have taken another near miss, you know, for them to really pay attention to our reporting. But I will say that after Hell and High Water ran, you know, we continued to try to hold officials accountable, because sometimes you plan these big investigations and then you go work on other things. And I think that's a problem. You have to follow up with people and ask people, what do you have to say about this? And so we tried to poll the whole congressional delegation, including the senators. You know, we didn't really get a response from Senator Cornyn. He actually sent us a picture of him meeting with like the Harris County judge. And we were like, okay, what did you talk? You know, more would be nice. And ultimately, you know, we wrote a story saying that the delegation is silent after we've published this investigation. And like a week or two later, you know, Senator Cornyn filed a bill in Congress, which ultimately was passed, I believe, as part of the Waters of the U.S. Act. It was a small thing, but it was a step forward in trying to fast track funding for the study to get the Ike Dike built. So there were actions that were taken. And I also really want to emphasize, I mean, there's a lot of kind of journalism about journalism going on with all these pieces, and that's great. But I also want to think about how the public is reacting to this. And it's kind of hard for us, I think, to know that or measure that when we're all kind of sitting at our desks typing away. And we had a huge amount of readership of Hell and High Water in Houston, which is kind of unusual for the Tribune. I mean, at least it was at the time. We've been trying to get out of Austin. We were based in Austin. We do Texas politics and policy. And I really think a lot more people became aware of the risks. And my hope is that the next time they think a category, even a category two, because we know it's not just wind speed now that's the issue, when they hear about these warnings and they think that Houston could be affected, that they actually evacuate and they don't stay.
So a question I would ask for all of you kind of extends out of that was, how much of an obligation do you think that journalists have, not just to get the information out there about these possible scenarios, but also to try to generate action and create change and change policy as a result of it? Where does our obligation of journalists as journalists fall in on that spectrum? Anyone?
Let me go first. I think I may be sort of on the most journalist-y side of the spectrum here. I'm not sure. We'll see how everybody else is. I mean, you know, I think environmental journalists are in a weird spot in that they do tend to feel a dual obligation. I felt writing my story more of the journalistic obligation to tell the truth and share the news from science. And I think most people writing about other areas don't feel that way. It's interesting, just this last week, I had a very brief talk with Ta-Nehisi Coates at his like book launch, and he was saying, you know, you really can't let people's need for hope get in the way of telling the truth about things. And if you do, you're just hiding facts from the public, and that's a really problematic position to be in. I basically feel that way about climate writing. But I would also say, you know, I on the question of the fear question, I think there is a use for fear. I mean, I think that people's fear of mutually assured destruction was a factor in denuclearization. I think that people's fear of like the, you know, cancer is one reason why people are now smoking less. And I think that there is important social science about the uses of fear and when it can be useful and when it can't be. But I think that it's a little too simplistic to think that anything that is scary is inevitably paralyzing to the public. And I think it's a little patronizing, frankly, as someone who was until recently like a non-specialist. And, you know, with climate in particular, I just think, you know, if people think that the worst case scenario is something like 2 or 2.5 degrees of warming, then like they're not just not going to be as motivated to act as they would be if they think that things could get worse than that and we need to take action in order to get to 2 degrees of warming. So, you know, I think in general, as like a broad project, I think it's true that it's, you know, it's good and helpful to write about solutions and write about what's, you know, reasons for optimism and programs that are being undertaken that can help. I think that generally, you know, that's absolutely worth doing, and it's journalism that I'm excited to read. But I also think that a story, frankly, personally, that a story that is just telling some bad news is worth doing too, if the bad news is real.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say, like, I'm not a journalist, so you can just totally disregard what I say if you'd like. But I would say that a journalist's job seems to me to expose people, and so the action often follows that. If you expose top officials for flying on private jets who said they were going to drain the swamp, you don't need to be an activist about that. You can just sort of show it, and then hopefully in a good system, action follows. And I would say that part of my research, I think, that has really demonstrated how journalists have led to activism of one form or another without being activist about it is the such important role that journalists played in the exposure of climate denial in this country. And if you look, it's actually, like, to me, a great academic failing that academics came so late to that discovery, and journalists and NGOs were on top of it. I mean, they were the ones showing the public how climate denial worked in this country and the corporate interests behind it. And then, of course, I mean, that you're talking in the sort of late 80s through the 90s, and now you still have people like Jane Mayer, I would say, out in front on that issue, as opposed to, I think, academics who are well suited to look at that kind of history and just aren't, really, to a large degree. And so I'd say that's a really good example of, first of all, the kind of reporting that nobody challenged as, like, doomsday reporting. And it's interesting you brought up Ta-Nehisi Coates, because in a way I was driving over here thinking, and also listening to an interview with him, but thinking that most of the time in environmental journalism, doomsday reporting is used with regards to natural sciences, that we call people who are reporting on hurricanes or climate change or coral reef bleaching, oh, you're using a doomsday scenario. We don't often say, like Naomi Oreskes, you're a doomsday person for talking about the collapse of Western civilization, or that you're doomsday Jane Mayer for saying that the Koch brothers are complicit in this. But it's with the Black Lives Matter issues and some of the issues that Ta-Nehisi writes about, he gets called a pessimist and a kind of doomsday reporter. And so that is interesting that it's not purely natural science, but I think in the environmental world, it tends to be more in that realm. And so I would say also that the place for, you know, activism is just in exposing some of these more social sides of the reasons why we're not acting on climate change, the reasons that we're not building infrastructure that should be built to protect people, and that kind of thing. And it doesn't have to go beyond that. Like, it's not like you have to have the click now phone your senator thing.
So what you're saying is that environmental journalists should take pride when people call them doomsdays.
I mean, right? I guess I would just say, put it in a broader context of the kinds of other kinds of stories that are being called pessimistic or doomsday reporting. I mean, the idea that you should be, like, well-liked as a journalist doesn't seem to me, or as an academic, doesn't seem to me like the most important thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really appreciate, you know, talking about exposing people. And it's exposing people that know about these scenarios and choose not to act. And it's also exposing people that don't want other people to know about these scenarios. I mean, I think that's a huge part of what we do. And it's one thing we try to do in this project. You know, and a little example of that is the state of Texas actually tried. They spent like a few million dollars or maybe tens of thousands of dollars on putting these like polls all over Houston at one point that talked about how high the water might get in a certain area in like a category 1, 2, 3. And, you know, the categories of, you know, certainly there's science that has changed about how we think about categories since then, and so there may have been other reasons that the polls were misleading. But essentially, just this act alone made people so angry in Houston, realtors in particular, that they took them down. So I think looking at, you have these scenarios, again, that we know are going to happen, that politicians know are going to happen. Who doesn't want people to know is also an important part of what we do. But I think in terms of solutions, I mean, if there are solutions that we can write about, I think we have a responsibility to write about them. Do we do it all in the same story? Like, could you have put that in your New York Magazine story? It probably would have been hard. It was probably a really long story already. I think we had a natural way of doing it in our series because of the ability to do visualizations. And also, we really had a responsibility to, because this is why scientists were putting their work out there. I mean, they were putting it out there in order to add, you know, I guess they were advocating, we were presenting their solution, their ideas for solutions, but there was a solution out there, so it would have been irresponsible, I think, for us not to make that a big part of our reporting.
So I'll just respond briefly. I think it's such an important question. I want to just clarify that that I'm not suggesting that fear isn't important or motivating or whatever, but that, again, going back to being nuanced about what kind of fear, what the context is, fear can be incredibly paralyzing and it can be numbing. Like, there's truth there. And at the same time, fear, I'm not suggesting that we don't want to scare people because they can't handle it. It's more about how we are thoughtful about the ways in which we're communicating about material that is, frankly, scary and very distressing. So for years, I've done journalism, but I don't identify as a journalist. And my fantasy is to speak to this question. Is there a responsibility? Because I actually think there is. I think there's a responsibility for environmental journalists to be cognizant and tuned in and mindful of the impact of what it is we're reporting has on people. Now, what you do with that and how that's translated, I think, can be done very creatively, and it doesn't have to become this, again, this kind of reductive, like, oh, let's only talk about the solutions and the positive stories that, you know, we've got Rachel Carson, we have so much precedent of journalists, of communicators who inspire action without saying go and do X, Y, and Z, right? So we all know that humans, we need the stories, we need the personal narratives, we need examples of what's possible. So for me, it keeps coming back to nuance and context. The more we provide nuance and context, and I don't know, I'd like to hear from you all if it just sounds outrageous to say that you have a responsibility to think about the emotional impact of what it is you're reporting, because I get really angry often when I see environmental news and media where it's like, what do you, like, you're just going to overwhelm people, you're just paralyzing people, but what else are you supposed to do? Because you have to report on what is happening. So I think that's the creative, ethical challenge that's facing us all right now, and something for us to imagine new and different ways of doing what we do.
Yeah, no problem. So before the last question I'm going to ask before I turn to the audience Q&As is kind of about the effectiveness of doing these kinds of stories. Nina, you already mentioned the great visuals that went along with your story and how important that was. But again, for all of you, I'd ask, you know, for a writer who is working on a story, trying to raise the alarm, trying to warn people about something that might happen, that could happen, that the science shows probably will happen, how do you go about doing that most effectively?
Yeah. I mean, I can just briefly say, you know, I think I also work for Reveal, which is a podcast and public radio show from the Center for Investigative Reporting, and you know, I think we were able to figure out a way to do our Hell and High Water series for radio as well. The show is called Mighty Ike, and we interviewed Mark for the show. It was worked out really well. And I think that offered us a way to do a little bit more of a narrative type of investigative piece along with the Hell and High Water series, which was a little hard to be narrative in a lot of it because there was just so much information. And I do think presenting a narrative is really important. I also think talking about how something almost happened will get people to pay attention. And I think Harvey is that the next step of like, okay, this, the big one almost happened. And what you have to do is kind of seize that moment. So we did all this reporting a year before Harvey, but when Harvey happened, we kind of snapped into it, you know, snapped back into attention. We had done all this reporting. We could quickly put it back out there because that's when people have the attention. And we've heard from officials and scientists who have been talking to us about this for years. They're saying this is 6 months after Harvey. This is our opportune. This is our opportunity. After that, it could be gone again and people could forget. But if we can get this in front of them over the next 6 months, you know, that's key. And so I think a lot of what we need to do is do the reporting. Sometimes it's going to come out at a moment where nothing's happening, you know. But you know it's going to happen one day. And when it happens, you know, you can use it. I mean, one of the things I loved about that New Yorker earthquake piece was it started out with a Japan earthquake. So the point being that I'm not, you know, she wasn't just talking about something out of thin air. I mean, something like this had occurred. And we know how devastating the tsunami and earthquake in Japan was. So I think talking about what has happened already and what impact that had and what policy solutions have occurred since then or not occurred can help people, you know, make this real for people and not just have it be like, you know, I just can't even contemplate this.
Anyone else?
Yeah, I would just say I think you're totally right about Harvey and Houston. I think generally this season of extreme weather is a huge opportunity for us to be. I think, you know, the public is really waking up to the fact that extreme weather and natural disasters are exacerbated by climate change. And I think that probably wasn't the case just a few years ago. And so I think it's really important to be doing this work now. In terms of what kind of work to do, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. It's really a question of, you know, creativity and trying different kinds of messaging out. You can use, you know, whatever tools you have in your toolkit. Hopefully some stuff sticks. I think we haven't yet landed on a single strategy. I mean, I think one of the values of my story was just that it showed that there was a different kind of magazine writing to do, but there are many other kinds too that people haven't quite tried out yet, and I think could be hugely successful. I think that one of the reasons why we've been as a group less creative than we might have been is that a lot of people are really worried about the scientists whose work they're writing about and what exactly they will think of how they interpret it. Which is something I went through personally myself. But I think generally science journalism and environmental journalism more particularly could stand to be a little more creative and a little more groundbreaking in terms of modes of storytelling.
So, I mean, just to jump in there, because I was particularly interested about your piece, it seemed like only Michael Mann really took issue publicly in terms of the experts being interviewed in the piece, right? Like Oppenheimer didn't say anything publicly.
Yeah, well, I don't remember the name of the organization that like grades
Climate Feedback.
Yeah. Did a survey that included a number of other people I had interviewed, and they were, I would say, they mostly offered some like minor criticism, but did voice public ambivalence about the story. But yeah, Mann was the most outspoken, and you know That's fair. He's allowed to do that.
I asked Mike to be here today, actually, since he's not far away up at Penn State. But unfortunately, his teaching obligations prevented him from appearing. But I would have liked to have had him as part of this discussion.
Well, I mean, I guess the reason why I asked that is that in some ways you go, okay, well, what is doom and gloom to the public can be very different than what is doom and gloom to experts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the public's having a hard time with that with regards to CPR, right? Like the majority of the public thinks that CPR works. And actually it works less than half the time, right? Because and doctors are quite comfortable with that idea. And so, you know, a lot of people who think about the solar system are very comfortable with the fact that the sun's going to burn out, but a lot of the public doesn't feel so good about it. So I think there's that. And so in terms of, I guess, effectiveness, I mean, that to me would be part of, if I was a journalist writing, appeasing, making sure that the scientists didn't say this was factually wrong, like what you were doing was wrong, but leaving the social science more in the hands of social scientists and in journalists, because the truth is that a lot of the people you interviewed are natural scientists. They're looking at climate models. They're not thinking about how fear interacts with the human psyche, and nor have they thought about that to a large degree. And the final thing I would say about effectiveness is, I mean, I think about this with my own job too, but we still do live in a country where it's an enormous privilege to get to do the kind of stories we get to do, the kind of research that we get to do, the kind of things that people are seriously being killed for in places like Brazil. And so I, as an academic, think, how can I use that privilege to its maximum? You know, how can I exercise this right that we have to tell stories, to tell the truth, to dig in, to investigate to its maximum? And that's the area where I would say, do you feel comfortable? Do you feel effective as an individual? Do you feel like you're maximizing the rights, the power, the privilege, the protection that you have in the United States?
Can I jump in?
Yes,
really,
and then
briefly?
I'll turn to audience Q&A.
Cool. So I guess I want to just really briefly pull back and just think about what it is that we're talking about when we talk about environmental issues. So the subtext of environmental issues and degradation and crises is what we as humans have done wrong, like how we've transgressed and what's happened there. And that the way, for many of us, we're still living and embedded in practices and ways of life that are connected with these damages and consequences. So there's kind of a story of unintended consequence going on. And so when I think about psychologically, how do we communicate effectively in ways that people can hear, I wonder a lot about what it would look like if our reporting, our communications had a way of acknowledging, because again, I'm thinking what disarms defense mechanisms? People get defense mechanisms activated when we feel guilty, ashamed, whatever, and environmental issues kind of bring a lot of that up. No matter how good of a communicator you are, that's kind of the deal, is like, what have we done kind of story there. And how do we navigate that? And I think a lot about messaging or storytelling, or that's really laying it on, like, hey, you know, we didn't mean for this to happen, but here's where we are right now, and we have this opportunity to actually deal with it. But what I found in my research, like in Green Bay, Wisconsin, around the paper mill and the industry, is a lot of people found it hard to engage with cleaning up the Fox River and Green Bay and the Great Lakes, because there was a lot of conflict around connection with pride around industry and way of life in that area. And I think that's a terrain that we're in a lot. So how can we acknowledge as compassionately as possible, like, hey, you know, this is our deal and this is what's going on. It's like, you know, arsenic. I mean, there's some really scary stuff. But to navigate that, I don't know if that makes sense, but just want to put that out there.
So thank you. So I'm going to turn to audience Q&A now. Reminder, the ground rules are working journalists and SEJ members first. Basically, if you have a blue badge, you're in that first group. And everyone, please identify yourself and your outlet or affiliation. So questions? Who wants to start? Right here, Tom?
Just a very quick observation and a question. The quick observation is that your story was very self-consciously about the tale of that distribution of events. And the other stories that we've been talking about were not in the tale. They were more in the very center of the distribution. We know that, right, what you wrote about is very likely to happen. In fact, you know, it pretty much has happened. So the question, though, is, and I think maybe more for Renee and Jennifer, should we be doing stories at that tale of the distribution? I mean, I've heard all of those things and wrestled with whether I should write about it. Oh, and I forgot to identify myself. Tom Yulesman, freelance writer and Center for Environmental Journalism. Should we do it? And if we should, when it's a good story, what are ways to improve it, where it's not just about fear, but that introduces some of the nuance that I think I'm hearing you say we need to think more carefully about. How can we do that better?
I'm going to try to summarize that real quickly for the record, but the idea being that David's story was looking like
pretty far out and was explicitly about kind of like worst case scenarios, not necessarily this will happen, but this could happen. Mm-hmm. And the question of how much should we do that kind of story? And if we do, how do we make it effective? Is that a good summary, Tom? Great. Thanks.
Well, I'll just really quickly say that, you know, I appreciate you saying that we're more in the center. I don't know if everyone has agreed with, you know, Hell and High Water was really looking at a Category 5 direct hit on the Houston Ship Channel, you know, a 500-year storm, assuming the 500-year frequency is actually correct, which, you know, probably maybe it's not. And so, you know, we certainly got attacked with people making that uncertainty argument. You know, hey, this only has a 0.2% chance of happening every year. You know, what are you doing? Why are you talking about this? When we did the Boomtown Floodtown, I think we talked about rain-based flooding, and that was a little bit easier for people to get their heads around. That was probably more on the center. So I think there is some actually interesting question as to what is tail end and what is center. You know, I just think it's worth – I'm not sure it's always clear, you know, how fringe are these scenarios, especially when we know that 100 and 500 year are probably not really the accurate frequency and maybe need to be – looked at.
Uh-huh. Other folks want to speak to that?
Okay. Why don't you go ahead?
Okay. I mean, so my own view on this, and again, it's not very academically informed, but is that hyperbole is always great in storytelling. And the risk to me seems to be if an individual, like if your next story was on the sun burning out and your next story was on a nuclear winter and in your next story. So that would be dangerous. And same thing if a news outlet ran story after like that. But it seems like from time to time, you know, these are great stories. The New Yorker isn't considered a doomsday outlet as far as I can tell, despite having this great doomsday story. So obviously, it can't be the bulk of what you do or what you do all the time. And that's where I think the doomsday, in a pejorative sense, has been most used against people in the science, actually, who can't veer from that, who can never tell an optimistic story because they work on the Greenland ice shelf or whatever. And they're like, sorry, I just don't see a positive story here. Sorry. And so the way I've seen doom and gloom most effectively used is against the scientists themselves who really can't choose to write next on Lindsay Lohan's naked body, you know?
I feel like when we're invoking the imagination, which is kind of what I think we're talking about, like invoking an, potential scenarios, that we do want to be – I keep thinking about young people who I talk to who are currently just living with a tremendous amount of fear and anxiety and despair because of something they've come across that presents the future in a particular way. And again, I keep wanting to go back to the – power of acknowledging to our readers, to our audiences, as much of the context as possible and to present things in terms of possibility, like this is what might be possible, and at the same time, you are part of this story. Do you know what I mean? Not to get too facile about it, but, you know, it's like, I think we have to be incredibly careful about projective kind of imagine it. What it does is it pulls us in as passive spectators, much like in a horror film, right? And so politically speaking, that's very dangerous when people are starting to experience themselves as passive, titillated, excited, fearful spectators of something that's unfolding. So it's very magnetizing, but it's also politically can be neutralizing. So I think, yeah, it's a hard one, but you know, I go back to acknowledging because that's what psychologists do. They say, "Hey, look, I know this must feel really scary, but here's the situation that's happening." And so that simple acknowledgement helps me actually engage more with what it is that's happening than if you skip that and just say, "Here's what's happening," and I'm, you know, people are left kind of floundering.
More questions at all? Go ahead.
Very quickly, I just wanted to underscore your great point earlier about the difficulty of distinguishing between tail risk stories. And I mean, you know, as recently as a couple decades ago, what we now think of as optimistic goals for climate change were considered disastrous scenarios. And these 500-year storms, three in Houston in 3 years. Obviously, that's an outdated term. So these goalposts can move really quickly. And as a result, I think we need to sort of pay attention to the full spectrum because we don't really know. I think often we think that uncertainty means that the scary things are less likely to happen, but it's just as likely for uncertainty to work in the other direction.
Mm-hmm. Great questions. I'll go to the back there. Yeah.
Don Corrigan, Times Newspapers in St. Louis. In St. Louis, for a number of years now, we've had a smoldering landfill that's getting closer to a radioactive dump. And when most of the coverage of this has been he said, she said, then the environmentalists say this is the terrible scenario that could happen. When they meet, and then the landfill operators say, don't worry, that's really an impossibility, or it's highly unlikely. So my question is it useful to do sort of a doomsday story on something like that? And my second question is, in the last session, they talked about how, and they lamented how environmental stories are weighed out on the list of national and international stories. Should the media maybe do 5 congressional districts where there are ticking environmental time bombs and say, here's 5 people who could lose their jobs in this country if the worst case scenario happens? Because here you have, this, for example, a smoldering landfill that's getting closer and closer to a radioactive waste dump.
So that's a difficult one to summarize, but let's see. Smoldering waste dump, radioactive landfill, how to cover that. So, but, yeah.
I really loved your question. It actually reminds me a little bit of a sort of mini – it's very different, but in Houston, you know, for those of you who followed Harvey, I feel like I'm seeing parallels with what's happened in Houston with what are called the Attucks and Barker reservoirs to the west of the downtown – that were built to protect downtown. It's like people are talking about how, you know, the dams, you know, have been considered at risk of failure for some years. You know, some people acknowledge it. Some people don't really want to comprehend. People are pointing fingers at each other. You know, I would say if there are credible, you know, not just environmental advocates, I think it's important to quote scientists. And that's one thing we really focused on in Hell and High Water. I mean, there were plenty of scientists who had academic data to show this and not just people who work, you know, not to downplay organizations, but people who had real academic data. So if there are people with real academic data, focus on them, quote them, quote the scenarios that they're talking about. And then you want to look at who knows this is going to happen? Who has admitted to you that it'll happen? Make sure that's out there. Who doesn't want to admit that it'll happen or wants to downplay? And I think that gets to your question of, I think it's a great idea to look at the local politicians in the area or members of Congress and say, here's what they have to say about this right now, and get them on the record. And if they don't want to talk to you, say that they didn't want to talk to you. You know, try and try and try. I really think when we did that, you know, we kind of did a congressional survey type of story after Hell and High Water. It was just one story. But I it's hard to know for sure, but I think it was effective. The last thing I would say is don't call it a doomsday scenario. I mean, this is, you know, if scientists are saying this could happen, then that's not a doomsday scenario to me. And I think that that word, we're ascribing it to ourselves, and I'm not convinced the public thinks that. So when you say that word, you know, I think you're writing yourself off. So I would just, you know, if there's really data to show that something like this could happen, and there's things that can be done about it. And that's the other thing, obviously. What are the solutions? And I would put that in your story because there seems to be such immediacy to it. But you know, I hope you can do a story. Go ahead, sorry.
I'll go to questions unless anybody else does. Yeah, great. So you had one over here, sir?
Yeah. I'm Tim Palmer. I live on the coast of Oregon. I'm in the magnitude 9 earthquake zone. And I write books and op-eds. And I've long held this kind of seat of the pants impression just by watching people, that fear is a very motivating emotion, but it does have these downsides. And then a more effective, though perhaps subtly different emotion is that of outrage. Mm-hmm. And if I can get people to feel outrage, mm-hmm. then I'm closer to getting them to act. Mm-hmm. And outrage involves, I think, also a sense of blame, mm-hmm. knowing that someone is responsible and that the bad outcome is not necessary. There are better ways to go. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So any thoughts on this? I mean, I write mostly about the natural environment and what's happening mm-hmm. to it. Mm-hmm. I actually go for 3 emotions in order. Mm-hmm. Love of the place, of mm-hmm. the planet, outrage at what's happening to it, mm-hmm. and a sense of hope.
So, yeah, quick question about the other emotions besides fear that you could have been employing in these kind of stories, whether it's, you know, love of place, outrage, hope. So, yeah.
I'll just jump in. I love that's a really great question. So, so fear, the thing about fear is that it's very closely related to shame, which is something that you've also looked at a lot. And those, obviously, we know that's a major barrier in the work we're trying to do is getting around the shame that comes up when we're talking about environmental issues. I think it's a huge part of this field, actually, unconsciously, a lot of the time. So again, going back to, so you mentioned love, outrage, and hope. I think there's a really important piece here that connect, almost like connective tissue between that, which is conflict, ambivalence, dilemmas, where we might be also having competing feelings of like love and also, you know, values or attachments that are part of the problem, and that can also be a place where people can get kind of hung up. Because, again, we're talking about industrial processes that we've also benefited from. And so when we raise awareness around the consequences, it can bring up this cognitive dissonance. So I would just kind of throw that out. Like, I think that's a really powerful heuristic, but it could be complicated. And the outrage piece is right on. It's just that that's also not sufficient fully to motivate. What do you think?
I mean, I'm motivated by outrage, the way that I study shame is so much in terms of the exposure and not people's personal experience of it. You know, that I'm just, I'm more interested in sort of the behavioral outcomes than the internal processing. So I think that I'm not enough of an expert in that to say whether or not it's motivating or demotivating, but I'll say that I've seen shame be very effective. In terms, again, of social exposure of individuals or corporations or groups that are just doing something wrong in terms of changing their behavior. But I think that also probably links a lot to outrage.
Mm-hmm.
Jennifer, I'll plug the fact that you wrote a whole book about the power of shame. So.
Okay. Punt away.
I love that. So. Yeah.
I just wanted to quickly say I wish I like had the perfect answer. I guess one thing I'll say about outrage is, yes, absolutely important. The question is, the reason I think it's not sufficient on its own is that, you know, is it coming at the right time or is it coming too late? I mean, I think people like in Houston right now are outraged when, you know, advocates or whoever else try to generate that outrage before the event. So it's like, how do you, and some of the way you can do that is talking about who wants to sweep this under the rug. I think that's an effective way. It's like, it hasn't happened yet, but these people know it's going to happen, but they don't want you to know. Mm-hmm. It can help. Is it effective enough is, I think, still a question on its own. Yeah.
And just one quick final note. I think outrage is hugely important, as all you do, but I would just say, you know, there's, especially when thinking about climate change, the big problem, I think it may be a little bit different than talking about, say, a kind of paradigmatic example of like a local polluter polluting a stream, which is to say that outrage can allow us to unburden ourselves of a feeling of responsibility and ownership of the problem. Climate change is truly, I mean, it is created by industrial capitalistic culture of which we all partake. And if we allow ourselves to think that there is a small group of villains who are responsible for it, I think it's part of the psychological phenomenon is that it lets us off the hook.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Question way in the back over there?
Hi.
You, yeah.
I was wondering if you would be able to comment about the idea of power and feeling disempowered in the context of these issues. Because it seems to me that if people feel like they can actually do something about it, they might be more willing to be open to pay attention to things, to changing the politics or whatever.
Can you identify yourself real quick, too, please? Thank you. So, question about power and empowering and disempowerment.
So, I mean, I don't want to be the naysayer among the group, but I will say, you know, to me, climate feels a little bit like gun control at this point, where it's like I'm outraged, I'm motivated, I'm willing to take responsibility, but I see no action. And so at that point, you say, what is the power structure? I'm feeling disempowered on climate. I'm taking individual responsibility, and I still am completely dissatisfied. And I feel like, you know, you don't have these same debates that are happening in Germany. You don't have them in the UK. I don't think journalists are as much self-flagellating there as they are here. And to a certain extent, then you ask yourself, like, what is really going on? And so while, you know, you may say that we all benefit from this capitalistic system and we all deserve a burden of a certain amount of responsibility for the problem, and we certainly do, I'm not afraid to give things up. I'm not afraid to vote for people who will force that on me. And yet I'm still completely dissatisfied. So I think that's when you start feeling that level of disempower, when you start having, you know, people who I think are really experts on this matter disengaging, saying I don't care anymore, or that I feel like there's nothing you can do. I think we have to look for new villains in the 21st century. We have to look for, because why is Germany taking this problem seriously and we aren't? And I don't think that comes down to any sort of feeling about personally being afraid or personally feeling despair. I think there's something bigger at work that we can all work to expose or fix, but in a more calculated way. This is not simply about our individual carbon footprints.
Anyone else want to speak to that, yeah, or go to the next question?
I'll just throw out that I think the answer is almost in your question, that I would say yes to everything you just said. And we all know that when people experience themselves as not having any efficacy or power, they will tune out and have really struggle to engage. And, you know, I've heard this in almost every single interview I've done, which is hundreds of interviews with all kinds of people, where the refrain comes in, well, what can I do anyway? And then what happens is there's a redirect of the energy, redirect to escape, to distraction, whatever. It doesn't mean there isn't a care there, but there's an experience of a lack of efficacy, which goes back to what can we do as communicators, which is to find ways of conveying what people can, where there might be opportunities for having more impact that aren't trite, but more examples of different countries, different communities that are actually engaging in different ways can spark a sense of, okay, I can kind of imagine how I might be able to relate with this or engage in a way that doesn't leave me feeling completely powerless and, you know. Right. Well, I'll just say, so I was involved with a project a couple years ago interviewing climate deniers, climate skeptics, conservative Republican folks around the U.S., and the subtext of a lot of those conversations was actually a profound sense of powerlessness, and not just around climate, but in general, a profound sense of vulnerability, uncertainty, and powerlessness. So it's not a cut and dry, like, okay, people who are denying climate are doing it because they feel powerless. But again, from the kind of more psychosocial lens, it's pretty clear that when we feel that we don't have any power, we will do whatever we can to avoid that feeling. And reframe it in terms of, well, the problem doesn't exist, or they're bad, or polarizing, or whatever. It's just classic kind of defense mechanisms.
Antonia?
Follow up on that. My name's Antonia Juhas. I'm a freelance writer. I focus on oil and energy. I've written for Gristmund recently, most often Harper's and Rolling Stone, outlets like that. I really wanted to get back on this question of, you know, as communicators, what does open up people's minds to listen? So I've heard, for example, that people don't really engage with a story until they're 30 minutes into a story. And it takes that long for the brain to say, okay, now I'm paying attention. And more importantly, yeah, that's right, wait, 10,000 word articles.
You're cut off, I'm sorry.
and more importantly, though, that it takes them that long to empathize with what's taking place. And so on this issue of fear, sort of, you're saying shutting off the brain. I mean, this is really important with the issues that we deal with. When I work on oil and fossil fuels, you know, fear is such a key point of what's happening in the stories. And the story we just did with Grist on Tiger Swan, the private security company protecting the Dakota Access Pipeline, one of the things that was constantly going through my mind is the whole point of having a private security company like that and infiltrating like that is to create fear among people who would oppose the pipeline. And so telling the story, revealing the lengths to which the private security company went to do its activities, helps elicit more fear. And in some ways, you know, to me, getting out the information is the most important piece and letting people work with that information. But in some ways, it's, you know, almost serving the function of having Tiger Swan there in the first place. And so, you know, sort of on this idea of what does fear do if it shuts off our minds, what turns on our minds?
All right, so really that was just a not-so-subtle plea for making stories longer. But but we'll summarize the question as you know, basically tips for getting readers to engage more.
Also what you're saying was the Donald Trump strategy, right?
Yeah.
Exactly, which is, he's saying something so outrageous to get attention, we give him attention, and people have been grappling with this and reinforcing the exact thing that they're hoping to work against.
Yeah. Well, this is sort of maybe addressing the other person's question from before, too. I think it helps people to think small a little bit. I mean, you know, they're looking at a big disaster that could happen, and you know, one of the things we've been grappling with in Texas is we have state leaders that, you know, don't totally acknowledge that climate change is happening or that it is caused by man. So it's like, where do you go from there? And one of the things we've been looking at is, okay, are they preparing? You know, does the state have a climate plan? You know, all those different things. I was amazed, like even Oklahoma's water agency was looking at, you know, preparing for climate change. So is Texas's water agency? Those kinds of questions. So, you know, it's more immediate term things. And I talk about evacuation a lot, but I really have been thinking about it, especially since Harvey, because I was amazed. I think some of this reporting, maybe it scares people. But I was the people who evacuated in Houston just from rainfall, even, you know, and the water was going to keep rising. They were hearing from people, their friends all over the country. Like they were hearing from a lot of people I talked to who decided to leave their homes. We're like getting texts from their friends in Maryland. It's like everyone, when more people are aware of what can happen, I think they inform other people in those small ways. It's not maybe the most optimistic, but to me, it's like we know there are going to be more disasters. If you live in coastal cities, I think Houston is a coastal city. I know some people would claim it's not. If you live in coastal cities, you know, you will know this, your neighbors will know this, your friends who don't live in coastal cities will know. And you can warn each other. I mean, it's a small thing. You can buy flood insurance wherever you live in Houston, even if you're not in the 100-year floodplain. I mean, those are small things. Of course, that's not enough. I mean, you need people who are not immediately affected areas to also make changes. But I do think that that makes a difference.
I'm going to say something. We have like a couple minutes left. So there's a book that a colleague of mine wrote called Resistance to Learning. It's an academic book by Marshall Alcorn. It's very academic, but it talks about the neuroscience of like how we learn and process information. And it comes back to aesthetics and experience. And so it relates to intimacy. It relates to the particularities. I want us to not answer your question with hope. Like, oh, all we need to do is give people hope and then they'll listen to what we have to say. It's like way more nuanced than that. It's way more complicated. I think people are engaged by feeling that there's some, obviously a narrative tension going on, right? But the other thing I want to point out is that we shut down when we feel overwhelm and guilt and powerlessness. So it's up to us to think about how do we assuage that or how do we deal with that? And one way is by acknowledging it right from the get-go. Is like, let's look at this story and let's look at the fact that this might bring up some of these things, but that this is not about that. This is about, you know what I mean? So
it's intimacy. I have an intimate connection to what you're talking about. Is that what intimacy means? Or just feeling more personally connected?
Both, yeah.
I think probably we're wrapping up, but to confirm sort of some of what is said, I think psychology and the fear-based stuff is really important with some sort of personal actions like evacuation, how you vote. But there is, and I would hope that every journalist would acknowledge this, some sociology to every story too. And it's interesting, psychology has been the discipline most involved with climate change, actually, of all the social sciences. Sociology is getting more involved now. But when you have evidence now to show that people over time And I think people who change their mind is a really interesting area for research. But over time, as they're exposed to Fox News over years and years, their belief in climate change declines. We know there's this top-down effect that is working somehow, interacting. And that top-down effect is often sociological in nature. There are invested interests who are choosing to convey this kind of information in certain ways. So that's, I guess, my sort of final point is just to not get too bogged down in the psychology, although there are important questions about how people react, but to also look at the structural and social systems behind some of those decisions.
Mm-hmm. So we are at the end of our time. David, do you have one last thing you'd like to say?
I'll make it really quick. I think that's totally true, totally important to think about the big power systems in which we're all operating. But just on the intimacy point, I mean, I think that Nina, your story about, you know, one of the reasons it's so powerful is that it was read by people whose lives it was describing. And one of the things I was trying to do in my piece was to talk about climate change not as something that happened to other people over there, but inevitably as something that was going to affect you, the reader, no matter where you lived. And I think that we're going to see that more and more in the sort of literally like the environmental story, the story that the environment is telling us. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also important to keep that in mind as we write, that the more that people can think that these things are affecting them directly, the more impactful they will be.
Mm-hmm. So thanks very much, everyone, for the terrific questions. Thanks for being a great audience, and thanks for the terrific panel. What's that? Oh, Mark, please. Let's live. Yeah.
You just put in a plug to continue this conversation tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. In our Covering the Disaster Beat panel.
Great.
The two great reporters who are invited? The two who are listed as invited? Are they?
Yeah, everybody's.
Good. All right, thank you very much, everyone. Lunch is in the ballroom. Appreciate it.